and say, okay, we can't do anything until we replace our entire global energy system. Well, that's just not a realistic thing to do. It's going to take us decades to do this, and we have to be mindful of which things that we spend our money on that are going to have the biggest effect.
This is The Butterfly Effect, a podcast that shows the big impact a small action can do. Tali Urad is talking to those special people that make a difference with nature and trees.
Welcome everyone to The Butterfly Effect. My name is Tali Urad. I'm your host and your butterfly here. My special guest today is Mark Cortez. Mark is the author of Climatory, A Journey into a Muddy Climate Middle. Climatory offers a new perspective on the climate crisis controversy through the pragmatic lens of a longtime renewable energy industry veteran, part science, part satire, and part snark. Mark is the founder and CEO of Liquid 8, a water conservation startup, and the professor of entrepreneurship and technology commercialization at California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo. Mark advocates for transparent climate decisions where half-truths are completed, climate science limitations are put into proper context, and politicians are held accountable for spending taxpayer dollars. Welcome, Mark, to The Butterfly Effect.
Thank you so much. My pleasure to be here.
So first, congratulations on the book. Can you just talk to me a little bit about it?
Yes, well, thank you. I didn't set out to write a book, actually. I spent the last 20 something years in renewable energy, mostly solar. And so I have really been working on the front lines of this for a long time. And geez, it was maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I noticed that the words that we're reading everywhere had just turned so dire and apocalyptic. And I started to kind of raise my hand saying, hey, wait a sec, this is not at all what my own experience says, but also what I have read, and it's just very different than what I know when I'm out there in the field doing things. Mm-hmm. And then the second part was I'm a father, and I also am working with young adults, sending them off into the world as a professor. And boy, they've been fed this steady diet of climate pessimism, as I call it. It's just, you know, just nothing but bad news regarding the climate. And now, they've been listening to this for their entire lives. I just didn't think that was the right thing to do. They're telling me that they're not going to be able to have kids because of the climate. And I think, well, wait a sec. There's a lot of other things that are going on here that you're not hearing about. So I started to write a little bit on social media. I started to have conversations, and it eventually just turned into a book. So that's kind of how some of these things happen sometimes.
That's exciting. So can you share some of those optimism?
Well, I think, it's hard to be optimistic in a lot of ways because all we hear are the doom and gloom. But yeah. I think one of the things I always go back to is let's remember that this entire climate journey is an effort in trying to predict the future. And, I'm always heartened by that because, as long as we've been trying to do this, yes, our information is getting better, but we've really yet to predict things. And so, yes, we're seeing some stresses on the planet. There's 8 billion people on the planet and we're stressing our resources, but there's also lots of reasons to be positive about it. I think we have a new awareness about what we're doing. We have some options that we didn't have before. A temperature of 1 degree rise over the past 120 something years has not destroyed humanity. And in fact, it has helped in a lot of ways. So I think that, there's different viewpoints on this as to what sorts of effects that a bit of temperature rise are having on the planet.
Mark, I have to stop you. I mean, in 2015, world leaders finalized the landmark Paris Climate Agreement. And we had there that we have to keep the global average temperature below 1.5 degrees pre-industrial levels. And this is based on science because climate models projection clearly show that warming beyond 1.5 degrees Celsius will dramatically increase the risk of extreme weather events and more frequent wildfire and sea level rising, change in flood and drought patterns, a lot of implication on our food system. So it's things are not up in the air, and it's not. I mean, this is serious, and we'll reach the tipping point if we'll continue in this path. So I'm just, I have to point it out, and I have to stop you there, because there is no, it's okay if the temperature will rise by one more degree. It's not okay.
Look, I think everyone would agree that just unabated temperature growth is, of course, a terrible thing. But what we're now finding, certainly with the science, is that a lot of the projections, especially the really apocalyptic projections, are just proving out to not be true in terms of some of the effects that they're having. And yes, we are stressing our resources, but there is not science that supports us heading quickly towards the apocalypse.
So it's all a question of how do you define quickly, and who will it affect? It may not affect me and you, but it will definitely affect our children if we'll continue with that trajectory.
Yes, of course. And it affects us. I think, you know, I do think that we are seeing some of the effects, but you know, I guess I work with literally thousands of students that are going off into the world now, and boy, this whole climate depression that we have put into them, it's not helping, right? It's just hopelessness. And they go into the world thinking that they can't have kids. And as someone who helped really commercialize the global solar industry, I take that very personally, because I think this is not the message that we started off with. This is not what we are trying to do. We didn't set out to scare children and to make them think that that everything was just going to end here in 20 years. And so I think trying to do that and actually communicating these messages has been part of, there's a strategy here involved to try to get people to be active and to care about this. But I also think that there's a big downside to this as well, which is why I was intrigued by some of the things that you say with some optimism, because there are things that we can do, and you know, our future is not by any means certain. There's lots of things that can happen. You know, all of these scenarios that are out there are just storylines. You know, we don't know any of them for sure,
right?
And so that's the big point of optimism, I think, is that there's lots of different things. You know, it's our future is still uncertain.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that you said it all depends on our actions, because it's definitely depressing if we sit on our hands, do not do anything, continue with the same things that we're doing right now, which will continue stress and push the planetary boundaries, right?
Yeah,
so if we sit on our hands, this is the doom and gloom is coming. But, and I think this is what you're saying, is if we won't, if we act, there are possibilities to change that. And then it's not just sending the message of a doom and gloom. Let's send a message of let's act. So my question to you, I guess, is I know you are the CEO of Liquid 8, which is, I understand, an Amazon-style marketplace for water conservation credits, right? So maybe talk to me a little bit more about that, because I feel like this is something that is done, right? And water is the next issue we are facing.
Yeah, I mean, Liquid 8, you know, I come from renewable energy, and, you know, things like renewable energy credits and all of the financial mechanisms that really helped build the industry, I thought we could do the same thing with water conservation. So here in California, even though it's been raining for 3 straight days, you know, we're in permanent drought. And so I said, well, why can't we bring some of those concepts into water conservation? So we're essentially incentivizing people to save water. And we take those water savings and we offer them up for sale in terms of the credits, similar to carbon credits. And so companies who are looking to zero out their water footprints but find that they can't, of course, because they actually manufacture things, they can buy these water credits to help do that. So it's essentially companies enabling their communities to save water on their behalf. So it's a way to conserve water, give financial incentives to people to save, to homes and businesses to help them save water, and then we sell the value of that to other companies.
Well, that's great. So I know there's carbon credit, but you're talking about water conservation credit. Is it like something you created? Is it like a standard in industry? Is it starting to get regulated?
Well, it's not quite that we're not quite there yet, and water has proven to be quite different than electricity. But we're creating it, and it's not more complicated than we put some monitoring devices on water meters. We monitor water usage. We put some programs in place to help them conserve water, and then we track their water savings, and all of those savings get put through our algorithm that basically says yes, these are real savings, or no, these have some climate factors and other things. But then once they get into the marketplace, companies can buy them, so they'll pay for a gallon of water savings elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. So is your target audience companies or individuals or both?
Initially, it's going to be companies. I think it's going to be larger companies who, you know, most companies, certainly most public companies these days, have large sustainability goals in electricity, clean energy and water goals. Mm-hmm. And so we're targeting those companies that are doing things to manage their water footprints.
And is it in a specific field or any company?
Any company. We're going to start by kind of surrounding the Colorado River here in California, but the seven states that are dependent on that, because that's where the drought regions are. And we've had a lot of really good interest from different companies in doing this. And so we're excited about it.
Yeah, it sounds exciting. And you're just giving them tips and guidelines on improving their current standards of work, or?
Well, some companies are actually currently evaluating ways to, like, they're going to go in and they're going to completely retrofit their operations to put in low flow toilets, for example, and really streamline their water operations. So we'll be able to capture those savings that they're getting. Mm-hmm. And we'll be able to capture that and sell the credits that they get from saving all that water.
Okay. And I mean, you said you're coming from solar, and I know in the solar industry, at least in the United States, governments are trying to incentivize companies and people to switch to solar. And mm-hmm. you were just mentioning even changing the toilets to be more sufficient in work consumption. I'm just curious if there's anything on that front, or you're just redefining the industry now, which is incredible.
Well, I think there are certainly some infrastructure things that companies can do, so they can go about re-outfitting their plants. But I think what they have found was, there's only so much you can do. So if you're Coca-Cola, for example, I mean, you sell water essentially, right? You're a beverage yeah. company, so. So even if you have large public goals that say you're going to be zero water, water neutral, mm-hmm. you can't get there. And so you can't conserve your waste to zero. And especially you can't reach down into your supply chain. So this allows you to do that. So if you can imagine 1,000 homes that are saving water, we'll put in programs that are more behavioral. So, you know, we'll be monitoring them. We'll have communications out to them saying, here's how much you're using. You know, if you use less than, we'll give them coupons and things like that for local restaurants and put in some incentive programs to help them, you know, to give them more reasons to save water.
Yeah. Okay. Now the latest IPCC report talks, the one that came in 2023, right, came out this year, actually talks a lot about water. Mm. And it has warned of looming global water crisis. And imminent risk of shortage due to overconsumption and climate change, right?
Yeah.
So it feels like this is really like tapping right in where the major problem is. So I'm just wondering if you have anything to say about that.
Yeah, you know, I think in general, our climate problem, and includes water, I include water in climate, is, you know, our climate problem is an overconsumption problem. And, you know, that really is what it comes down to. And so here in the U.S., you know, we're leading the charge of that, for better or for worse. We like to consume lots of things. And so I think one of the things that I have been frustrated about, but also encouraged by, is, you know, the biggest lever we have on the climate front is conservation and just deciding to use less stuff. And ironically, that one of the best things to happen in the climate game in the probably the past 30 years was 2020 COVID. And as terrible as that was for everybody, but if you look at the numbers in terms of emissions, you know, in 1 year, the U.S. dropped our emissions by, 11% or something like that, and 15% in transportation. So in 1 year, 12 months, we did what 30 years of climate policy and hundreds of billions have not been able to accomplish. So it tells you that there are answers out there that we're just not even looking at. And so conservation is one of them. And I think my company is... if you want people to conserve, pay them. This is not rocket science. Back in the day when we wanted people to adopt solar, we paid them. And, it works. It's not that difficult. And so, you know, I think part of the problem or the challenge is when people hear conservation, they think of scarcity, right? They think of, you know, of one light bulb in their house, and their mind immediately goes to this really dark time. But that's not true. I mean, yes, COVID was bad, but you know, conserving 10% of a home's energy usage is just not that hard. I've got two teenagers, and I could do that in a week just by making sure that my teenagers run around the house and turn their dang lights off, right? So, so there's lots of things like that we can do to help things. And so I'm a believer in conservation. I think it's something that no one ever talks about, but it's also one of the biggest levers we have.
So, what other things we can do, right, besides sending our teenagers to turn off the light?
We have an overconsumption problem, right? And so our answer on all of our solutions are more consumption, right? We're building, solar modules and windmills and electric vehicles and batteries, and all of these things continue to add CO2, even though they add it at a slower pace. And so we can't consume more to less consumption. It just doesn't make sense. And so I'm a believer in conservation. I think that nature preservation, you know, I keep in thinking in my mind, can you imagine if all of our national parks became national carbon sinks and trees were a protected thing? And I mean that, you know, think of all of these natural solutions going into places and cutting down all the trees so you can put in factories to build solar modules or windmills to help us save the planet just seems ridiculous. And so preserving nature, there's all of these natural solutions that we don't really ever talk about in terms of helping pull carbon out of the air and store it. And so I think those are not very, we haven't looked at them very much, and you don't ever hear people talking about them, but I think it's a real opportunity.
The nature-based solution. I'm all for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what have you learned from the solar industry that you feel is important to bring into the water one, water conservation one?
You know, number one, we're to this point in the climate is we've been talking about stuff for so long. What we need are things, we need proof of stuff, right? Not only, I mean, I could go on about the science and where, you know, where we need some work in that, but you know, in terms of the results, and one of the challenges that we have with solar is that all of this sort of avoided emissions stuff is, these are all still just estimates and guesses into the future. When we first came up with this idea, we did it because we wanted to show customers comparatively how, you know, hey, look, if you install this solar, it's potentially this much better than, you know, getting your energy from coal plants or natural gas plants, right? So we did this comparison, But there's so many variables that go into that that you never really know if you actually ever save anything. And we've certainly found that as we've gone out into the market. So I think one of the things is we're looking for proof of things that work. And so all of this future avoidance stuff is a really difficult way to plan our climate, because you never know if all that stuff in the future was actually avoided or if it was ever going to happen in the first place. So one of the things that we're trying to do with water is we're just using real numbers, right? So I can look at the data. I could say, look, August of last year, you used this much. August of this year, you used this much. Let's look at the numbers. And you can actually see that there was less water running through that pipe. I would say most people would agree that we need to do something pretty strong and direct towards the climate, and we're struggling with what do we do? And so part of it is really getting some real data and some real answers out there to people.
So I would say that we do have data, right? Scientists have data. Maybe we do not want to look at it, we don't like it, but it's there, it exists. And I mean, if we're using coal, the impact of coal is not just specifically in terms of your light bulb. It's more of also the emission it brings back to the atmosphere. It's the, yeah. Right, there's like need to look at the full picture. And I mean, I know you're not a climate denier, but one of the things we need to be careful is it can come across like that. And we do not want to confuse people and say, well, you can continue burn whatever you want. It's going to be great. It's just like people will tell me, yeah, we'll grow a tree and we'll cut it down. It will sequester carbon and then we'll burn it. I'm like, oh my God, no, this is horrible, because all the emissions you just, right, just goes back to the atmosphere. You just made a huge, right, even if it grew for 20, 30, 40, 80 years. So,
yeah. So here's our challenge. Look, I come from the solar business. I've done the math 1,000 times. It's not going to save us. It works when it works. When we size solar systems, it works. We size it for 5 hours a day because that's typically what you get. So what do you do for those other 19 hours? That's one of the challenges with solar.
But wind. Isn't there like batteries that stores the... Yeah.
Sure, there's batteries to store, but now that's a secondary technology, right? That now you're adding something else to it. So that's the first section is, you know, you put these things together and that, you know, the solar plus battery storage is still pretty much in its infancy. You know, we've got some in California, but it's not a broad solution yet. Second thing is when you do the math about how much manufacturing capacity we have, it's not even close. Okay. I did one of the things I did in this, in my book was, I just said, all right, how many solar modules can we make a year, and how much will we need over the next 30 years? And the number was ridiculous. It was like, based on current capacity, it was like 130 years of full capacity, right? So it's not even close. So what does that say? That means we either have to start cranking out factories and adding all of that into the atmosphere, right? Or we need to find other ways to do this. So, you know, it's just not, It was never meant, solar was never meant to do what we're trying to have it do, which is be a baseload, 24/7 reliable thing. And batteries are just in their infancy. We don't have, I mean, you're talking hundreds of years to make enough batteries to power the world. And so let's back it up. I'll go. We're chasing solutions that have yet to save even one town.
What do you suggest if you say, okay, so solar is not sufficient enough, right? So what is?
Well, I hate to say it, but nuclear is a better option than you know, it's the cleanest energy source we have. Now, I'm not a nuclear. I'm not going to sit there and say I'm an advocate for nuclear energy. But if you look. If you look at all the numbers, it's by far the cleanest, that and hydropower. So I think any serious look at our energy future has to include nuclear. It's just the math on it is pretty clear, and I know that that's a tough one for a lot of people to get their heads around. But it's an energy source that we have not yet, you know, that we need to take seriously if we are serious about global decarbonization. I think that's the way it is. Again, I believe in conservation. I believe in nature preservation. I don't think that there are. I also believe that we need to be investing in technologies like carbon removal technologies they're not fully commercial yet, but we need to be looking at them as ways to help attack CO2 directly. We absolutely need to have a decarbonization plan. I'm not suggesting any of that, but having that be plan A, I think, is not going to yield the results that we think that it will.
So if I understand what you're trying to say, is there's no one solution, and there's no let's just head towards net zero, or let's just head towards technology, or let's just work towards green energy. It's all of them. It's reconsidering some of them, right?
Yes, of course. I think I really do think that we need all of them in our arsenal. Yeah. I think there's no one size fits all. If you take any of these by itself to its extreme, I use solar as an extreme example, it just doesn't work. It just, you can't get there. You can never get to your goals by doing this. You can't do it with windmills. You can't do it with solar plus batteries. Our problem is, number one, we consume too much. So attacking consumption makes perfect sense. Number two, we've got too much CO2. If you believe in all of the science and all of the things that are out there, then we've got too much CO2. So slowing down the growth of CO2 isn't good enough. We have to actually take it out of the air. And that's where nature-based solutions come in. That's where trees come in. That's where carbon removal technology that we have yet to commercialize comes in. Mm-hmm. Those are actually built to do that. And so I think that rather than kind of backing into some benefits with cleaner energy, have that, yes, be part of the answer, but we need to be attacking this directly.
Yeah. What is your biggest challenge right now?
My biggest frustration is, and part of it was why I ended up writing this book was, I think there is so much damage that's being caused by encouraging us to panic, because panic leads to really bad policies, and we've seen it. And our policies, I don't know of anyone who thinks that we're making good progress on the climate front. I'm frustrated probably for a lot of different reasons than other people are, because I don't think that panicking is the right way to do it. I think a generation of scared children is a really bad thing. And so for me, that's why I've undertaken this journey, because, hopelessness is just hopelessness. As you said, when we first started this conversation, it was kind of like, well, if you're hopeless, you just throw your hands up in the air and say, well, it just doesn't matter what I do, right? Well, that's not the message.
Yeah.
The message is we can do this, but we have to kind of take the bullhorns away from people and yelling louder about the same things we've been yelling about for 40 years. It's not working. But number two, we have to be realistic about some of the things that we can do. And if we gutted our number one energy source tomorrow, we would all be in big trouble. Way worse trouble. And so we need, I've watched solar modules get made. It is not a clean operation. These are tractors mowing down hills to get at all of the minerals in there. And they're feeding factories to make these things. So there's no such thing as energy innocence. And we just have to be smart about that, but also be truthful about it.
So I have a question to you.
Okay.
You're saying that putting solar panels destroys the land, right? We need to cut down. But what about the ideas of, and I see it a lot, ideas on putting solars on parking areas, industrial locations, buildings. I mean, you see it a lot in the Middle East. Basically, every house has a solar panel. So
yeah.
I understand why you're going towards, okay, we need to go to the fields, but there are other solutions that can be done that we should be doing, and I don't think we do.
Yeah, I mean, look, solar, I like solar. I think it's a good thing, and I don't mean to pick on it, but But it doesn't lower CO2.
Lowering CO2, right? But it lowers our consumption.
It lowers our consumption of another thing that is bad, but it's also bad. So, you know, look, so solar is made, all of these things are made in factories. So if the goal is to get, I believe that our goal isn't to get to net zero, because even if you get to net zero, we still have a long way to go. We still have to get to net, we have to get to net negative. And you can't get there with solar. You can't get there. You can't get there with any energy source, that anything that adds CO2, you can't get there. So, I think it makes sense, but in terms of the priorities of different things to spend our money on, are we going to spend money on things that don't solve the problem, but just slow down the growth of the problem? Or should we attack it? Should we spend our money on things that actually attack the problem directly? That, like, electric vehicles, for example. Look, they're fun to drive. I've driven Teslas before. They're great. They're great pieces of tech, but they're absolutely not going to save the planet. You know, I mean, a Tesla off of the assembly line has a higher CO2 footprint than an internal combustion.
That is correct. Yeah.
Right. So, and in fact, it only catches up depending on a bunch of variables, like where you charge it and the energy mix of the utility that you're charging at, when mm-hmm. you charge it. So you have to drive this thing for, 50,000 miles in order to catch up. That's not getting us better, right? And in fact, I'll say it differently. It's actually giving us a false sense of security. So, like, people that this proliferation of electric vehicles, people are saying, well, we need more of these. I say to them, no, you're making the problem worse. You're actually adding CO2. You're consuming more manufactured products. So there's no way around this. There's just no way around this. If you're out, so the answer to that is don't buy it. The answer is to, if you really are concerned about it, and I have this conversation all the time, don't tell me that your Tesla is saving anything. It's not. And it's super, super expensive. There's $30,000 of public money in every single Tesla.
So it's better to not buy the Tesla and to continue drive the, Ford, Mazda, Honda.
No, drive less. I'm saying drive less. So demand is not inelastic. You can, and we just proved this work from home one day a week. You just cut your traffic consumption by 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we know that we can do this. Take public transportation for another day. Okay. So you've just cut your driving by 40%. Things like that. There are choices that we can make. Don't replace the TV every year. Make it last for 3 years. I'm doing this right now. I have a TV in my house. I go, there's a bigger and better one. It's, I could get it. I'll just throw this one out. No, I'll just make it last.
Yeah.
So there's all of these tiny little things that we can choose.
Yeah.
But I love
fix
Tesla,
where it's broken. Yeah. No, I got it. Yeah, I got it.
So it's just a different way to look at things. We're really in a rush to, I look at this and I go, look, we've got this oil infrastructure. We've used our existing energy sources that have taken us this far. And now we collectively know that, hey, there are some significant bad sides. Do we need to transition away from that? Yes, of course. And I think most people agree to that. The question is, is it like a cancel culture thing where you press the button and say, okay, we can't do anything until we replace our entire global energy system? Well, that's just not a realistic thing to do. It's going to take us decades to do this. And we have to be mindful of which things that we spend our money on that are going to have the biggest effect. And that's one of the things I did in the book was I used some existing resources. Project Drawdown has this great list of different solutions by dollar amount. And I ranked them. I said, look, here's the best bang for the buck. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, the best bang for the CO2 dollar, in other words, the cheapest things that we could do that will have the greatest CO2 effect. And EVs are way down on the list. And things like solar, like I think the top solar one was like 33, which means that there are 30 other things that we could do that are cheaper and more effective. And a lot of them are natural solutions, trees and regenerative farming and education and all of these other things that we aren't even considering at this point.
So how do you stay optimistic?
Part of the challenge, and goes back to the frustration, is, you know, we're just not having dialogues, right? We're not talking with people, and we don't all have to agree on things. But in my experience, most people agree that we need to do something about the climate. And so I always start with that, you know, regardless of where we're coming from, most people agree that. And I think that's a big point of optimism, back to the optimistic part, yeah, where we talk about trees and nature and things like that. You know, we agree that we need to do something. So we have to constantly remind ourselves about that. But we also have to do exactly what you and I are doing, which is having a conversation and be kind of willing to be a little bit uncomfortable and saying, well, here's what I've heard, here's what I believe, you know, how do we get to that point? I believe that we need, you know, both political sides to embrace this, and that really we need an approach that's going to span presidents and span administrations, because we just can't keep bouncing back and forth, you know. And I think that's one of the things that I'm hoping a dialogue like this will help change, is we need both sides on board with this. And I actually do believe it's possible, and that's where I'm optimistic, is we just agree that we need to solve this. And I think most people do that. And so I'm optimistic about that. I think that I really do think that people genuinely want to care, or genuinely want to solve this problem and attack it and feel good about it and quit feeling bad about it.
So I love that you keep on mentioning trees.
yeah.
Yeah, my best go-to solution, which is just my favorite, but it doesn't mean it's the only solution. So I'm just curious, what is your favorite tree?
Oh, my favorite tree. I'm a California native, so and I live in San Luis Obispo, surrounded by California oaks. So the California oak is my favorite tree. I just... you know, they're just these white gnarly beasts, and they're beautiful. Everyone is different. They look like something out of a haunted mansion movie, and I just love them. They're everywhere. They're just I just find them very distinct, and so I just think they're really cool trees.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate
Thank you very
the time.
Much.
And thank you everyone for joining me today. We are all beautiful butterflies, each in his and her individual ways. I wanted to thank you for joining me today in this episode. I really appreciate you coming on this journey with me, and I hope you can join me next time. And remember, it only takes a small action to make a big difference. Be a butterfly.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. Please subscribe to hear more of our stories of change.